Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Born in Spain with a Spanish father and a mother from Peru, Gonz Ferrero grew up in the midst of Buenos Aires, Argentina. Despite growing up in a highly urban area, he eventually found his way into the mountains. Follow along in this interview that will take you through investment banking and project leading solar parks in Spain, to starting a big media company in Shanghai. Through the Himalayan mountains, aiding nuns in the Andes, winter seasons in the Alps, to finally end up at a pizzeria in Duved, Ora. Today, Gonz Ferrero is the CEO of the almost mysterious brand Klettermusen, with a history that spans for more than 40 years. My name is Magnus Ormestad, and this is episode 33 of the international series of the Swedish outdoor podcast Husky. Husky is made possible thanks to Naturkompaniet. If you want to know more about this episode and the previous ones, head over to huskypodcast.com. You can also follow Husky on Facebook and Instagram at the handle huskypodcast. So how has 2020 been so far, life and business during COVID-19?
It's been a, I think it's been a roller coaster so far, for sure. On the personal side, it's been, you know, we've had actually an unfortunate death in the family actually a few months ago, so that was added on top of sort of everything else. But I think even on the professional side, I think that line has been blurred, you know, since everyone started working from home. And so, I mean, it maybe almost, we're almost out of the other end. So I think with a bit of retrospection, it's been educational year for sure. Humbling and also somehow, you know, we've sort of armed ourselves with some of the lessons we're taking away. But I mean, when we were in January, I don't think we expected any of it. When we were in February, even when we were in March, we expected it to be like this. And I think we, me and many, if not all business owners or CEOs are in the same boat right now, where we just have no visibility. And that's a strange feeling to operate under.
Right? It's kind of trial by fire, sort of.
And it was just simple. I mean, we're in a relatively simple business. You know, it's two seasons, you know, and sort of it repeats itself twice a year. And, you know, and you, some of the orders are pre-ordered, and some are. There's an element of surprise or that you always buffer in. But at this point, you know, for the season we are in now, of autumn winter 20. We have no idea if the slopes are going to be open, if we're, are we going to be able to travel, if the shops will, you know. Usually it's just a question of, is it going to be a good winter or not? That we can manage, but it's testing. At the same time, you know, they say you should never let a good crisis go to waste. And that's been kind of a bit of a ethos internally in the company as well.
This is a huge question now, of course, but the effects on society that you see coming from the COVID-19 crisis. I mean, you are especially interesting because you are not you are a kind of multinational, so you have a different perspective, I think.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, if I remove myself a little bit and try to leave my personal opinion or bias, but I think what you definitely see is that in general, people have become a little bit more conscious of each other, and you know, and that's in some aspects that's coming out in positive ways. Like, okay, do people in my community need help? Should I go shopping for elder? We had been going through many years of where that was disappearing. So now everyone's looking around, meeting their neighbors, seeing who their neighbors are in a better way, I think. But at the same time, we were also looking more inward. We were talking about that before with countries shutting down borders and not being to coordinate. That's been a bit disappointing for everybody. I think so. Bittersweet. From an outdoor perspective or from nature perspective, I think that's been fantastic to see that trends that we had identified, or let's say we even relied on, have been accelerating over the last few months, right? People all of a sudden don't want to go to Ibiza. They want to go,
hiking the King's Trail.
Exactly. Or doing the Jamaland Triangle or something. Yeah. And that's super. I hope that never goes away. We had, my generation, our generation, for us as kids, it was a huge treat to get on an airplane and go somewhere. And then when we start having money and stuff, then that's all we can do with our free time. So I think hopefully the generation that we were so afraid, that was so into social media and so digital and TikTok, and maybe those guys are now seeing the value of those experiences.
Yeah.
As opposed to the value of having many experiences.
Yeah. And going from something, we live most of our lives very, very abstract. Our work is often very abstract.
Yeah.
The products are no longer physical products. It's very abstract digital products. And a lot of our interaction and activities are also very digital and very abstract. So and now we see a lot of people looking back and going back to the simple stuff, like having a sandwich out in the forest and a cup of coffee.
Yeah,
and that's of course very good.
I was looking at this for tax reasons, actually. But all the flights that I took last year, or last summer, and all the flights I took this summer, which was basically none, and then you immediately, I can immediately tell you what I was doing last year was completely non-sustainable, not just from an ecological point of view, but just from like a lifestyle perspective. And I think so many people were in that wheel, and now are not. And I hope that's, at least, speaking about me, but I think in general, people are not going to go back all the way, right? We might find a new in-between point where the pendulum swings back a little bit, but in general, I think people have a better perspective of what it is they want, how they need to balance, how they want to balance, and feel a little bit more empowered to do that as well, right? Taking, working from home or taking a video call with your kids in the background, I think that was a big no, even in Sweden, I would say, a year ago. And now it's
standard.
Standard.
Yeah. Where is home?
So my wife and I have a deal that I can only say that home is where we live together, right? So home is London. Our house, our home, my wife's work, and our son, and our daughter who's coming, are all in London. And I have Clatmusen headquarters is in Åre, and that's home for a different side of me, and a special place where I managed to find everything that I don't have in London. And then Stockholm, which has become a very interesting place for us also from a company perspective, really dynamic. And so I'm in between, but I think Åre and London are probably, or London and Åre, I would have to say.
But hey, I just thought of a thing that both London and Åre share. Poor weather and low visibility.
Yeah, impossible to predict what weather will be the day.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Åre is a fascinating place that I am still trying to figure out. And it has, I realize it has very different connotations for a Swede than it does for a non-Swede, right? When I first arrived in Åre, it was November 2015. It was cold and dark. Dark, like really dark, darker than I had ever been.
Like before the snow as well.
Yeah. And I remember thinking, there's nothing nice about this place. And that was the really honest to God, my first reaction. And it grows on you. That's nice. I think London is similar to in that way. It kind of has to grow on you, you know, because of course, as a tourist, you can have a fantastic, you know, weekend in the theaters or in the restaurants. But if it's somewhere where you're actually going to spend time, you know, you actually need to have see the full picture. I think,
But what is such a it's a small community in a very small village, but it's still, because of course of the ski resort, it's still got kind of a cosmopolitan vibe to it.
Yeah,
and not only because of tourists coming, but they have the restaurants, they have the cafes and bars and so on. They had kind of another tradition that you would expect from a small mountain village in Sweden, I would say.
Yeah. So one of the things that surprises me even today about Åre is that everyone looks up. You know, nobody looks to the river, to the lake. So it's sort of it's strange, because even in the summer, you know, now it's biking, but you know, a few years there was not such a big biking community, and then you know, you just wanted to go kayaking or swimming or even running on the beach, you know, and there is no such thing. It's a, you know, Åre is, you know, I think Åre is almost a bit of a twilight zone, because it's, you know, it turns on and off, you know, and that's strange, right? If you live there and you have that sort of community and, you know where things are and that routine and everything. But in my scenario where you're coming in and out, it's, you know, you're sort of always, you're almost feeling like you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then people are, you know, don't really know what to make of you. You don't really fit. And it's become much younger, much more sort of open to this type of, in the last 2 years, I would say, than it has before. And I think that's been very welcomed.
Yeah, there's a lot of things happening with, I mean, from the business side as well, with House B, like the business hub over there. So it's you've got that perspective. That part's growing as well.
I like the. I'm very excited about the plans I've been hearing for Dubed as well. Sort of expanding this, because Åre is, you know, we talk about Åre commune, I think, right, when we talk about Åre. And so the city itself is, as you said, the mountain village, but I think most of the people in our company live outside, and, you know, live in the mountains and things. And so Dubed is a fantastic place that I keep getting flashbacks to the first time I went. In that November 2015, I was looking for a place to have dinner. And most of the restaurants were closed because the season wasn't open yet. So I was driving around, and I went to Dubed, and there's a pizza place in Dubed. And I came in and I was, you know, with a bit of my Latin charm, was trying to be funny. And I asked the guy, "Oh, is this your pizza good?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah, it's even people from Ore are coming here to eat pizza." I was like, "Oh, okay." I guess, you know, if people are driving for 5 minutes to eat here, it must be great. Yeah. So
that's a good slogan for them to put over their door.
Yeah.
Even people from Ore. But you are not from London. You are not from Ore. Where are you born and raised?
I was born in Spain, from a Peruvian mother and a Spanish father, and we moved to Argentina when I was about six. So, and I'm the oldest of three, so we all grew up. You know, that move caught us at different ages, but I spent most of my young life in Argentina before going to university.
But was it like an urban life or on the countryside or apartment or house or?
It was very much an urban life. Yeah, we were based in downtown Buenos Aires.
That's very urban.
Very urban. Yeah, I think the nature comes from being very humid, very almost tropical. So you get these incredible trees, incredible flora inside the sort of urban, and the fact that the city, you know, was one of the most beautiful cities, you know, by World War II and hasn't been, you know, touched since. So it's almost, it has this contrast of old time machine type of, you know, but it was very urban. Yeah, absolutely.
But you're, I mean, I think we all know what it's like to grow up for most people, of course, in Sweden with a friluftsliv, like the Swedish outdoor culture. But what was it like? How was your friluftsliv like? Your upbringing when it comes to spending time in the outdoors?
We didn't have that. I didn't have that at all. My parents were not very into outdoors. In fact, they weren't even into summer holidays and beaches and things like that. So, you know, most of the nature growing up was the football pitch. I mean, that's sort of where you saw green, or on the TV watching football. it certainly isn't a part of life. It wasn't a part of life for me growing up. Occasionally we tried to escape, you know, with school plans and do ski trips and things, but
because there is good skiing in Argentina, right?
Yeah, there is.
Pino Torres, what's it called?
Yeah, Bariloche, Las Leñas. There's a couple of good places in the Andes, and then there's actually better ones on the Chilean side, actually.
Okay.
And it's not uncommon for people in Buenos Aires to ski.
But it's kind of a, I mean, compared to Sweden, it's of course a matter of class and social class and economy, of course, in Sweden as well. But I think even more so, probably in Argentina,
yeah.
It's more the people are the well off. They go skiing, yeah. I guess.
I think for us, apart from the fact that my parents were just not really, you know, had not been raised like that, I think we being living in Argentina, but with family in Peru, with family in Spain, most of our holidays were basically
visiting relatives,
going back or going for, you know, and doing that. So it's been, we had a very social family. We did everything that, you know, in the friluftsliv context that you're doing outside. But we were doing it, you know, in a Latin context. I think. Yeah, we didn't really appreciate. I certainly didn't appreciate the value of nature growing up.
But where did that come from? Did you have a? Did you dream of adventures?
I think all young boys dream of adventures. When it came time to go to university, I didn't want to stay in an urban environment. I don't know if that was conscious or subconscious, but I purposely chose a university in the U.S. that was in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, sort of southern Virginia. And that was the eye-opening, or was, let's say, the first eye-opening. It was beautiful, you know, picture your your beautiful wrecked bricks type of U.S. university campus lost inside a Shenandoah Valley with lots of students from Portland and Washington State. And then, you know, that became, you know, hey, those guys are cool. I mean, they go hiking, they go kayaking, you go tubing, you know, and that.
They do what?
Tubing, where you go down the river in this tubes, you know, it's like tires.
Okay.
So you grab a six pack of beer and you sit on top of the tube and then just float down.
Float and get drunk.
Drinking beers, exactly. Mm. And there was perhaps, you know, as university years are, everything is exciting, everything is.
Yeah.
So that was a romantic experience. But then, you know, then you graduate university and you have to get a job and somehow that romanticism fades away into, you know, you never have time. And so I lost that, yeah. I must say, after university when I went into my career.
But what was your career plan? What did you envision yourself like 10 years from university? What was your major and stuff?
Yeah, I had a business administration major. Liberal arts education. So in the US, you do 2 years where you're basically do everything from philosophy, mathematics, and then in the end, you'd go for something. And I went for something practical, which was business. And then I graduated wanting to go for a year as a gap student. And that was a fairly strange concept coming out of the US that, you know, that's more of a European concept, but I wanted to take a year. And the day before I was going to leave on a Eurorail train, I got a job offer in Spain, in Madrid, to work for an investment bank. And, I had to make a choice. You know, do you go for this, you know, gap year or, and I chose the job actually. So I stopped all my plans and ended up sitting, you know, the day after in a desk.
Selling your soul.
Selling my soul, let's say, yeah. a mix of, you know, wanting to, you know, prove yourself. You know, you graduate from university, everyone has a job, you don't have a job. So, and I, yeah, so I pulled the trigger. And since then, I think that's, you know, that sort of has driven a little bit of the thinking. We have, you know, I have to do something to set the record straight, right? I didn't last so long in investment banking, a couple of years. I quickly started looking and thinking about, the environment. You know, my first job after investment banking was, developing photovoltaic parks, doing, solar energy.
Okay.
So we had, We and a few friends had gotten together and project managed the development of 250 megawatts solar parks in the southwest of Spain. Mm-hmm. You know, a little bit of, you know, that mentality as well. You know, it's the same thing that ties you to nature. Like, why are we here? You know, what is there? You know, what are we supposed to be doing with our time? Right?
Like the sustainability mindset has always been, or maybe not always, but it has been present with you for a long time.
I think the sense of responsibility, and that's always come in first. Maybe it's from being an older sibling, or from sort of being a bit, you know, multicultural, or there's definitely always has been a sense of, okay, why. Let's do the best we can. Let's do something that is not just the basics. I think being in investment banking, especially, I think that can either dumb down that feeling or it can actually make it come out to the surface.
Yeah, it's kind of a investment banking and that kind of raw sense of capitalism is kind of a untamed force, sort of. So you can make it work for you in the sense that you can summon the energy from it and do good.
Mm.
But that's not always the case, I guess.
My point of view on investment banking is that it's you know, it's a fantastic platform to learn and to you know, as you graduate and you go into the workforce, you know, you have no idea, right? And so investment banking is a place that has enough structure. You know, it's project based, so you're in and out and you're learning, and it's a hierarchical system of mentorship as well. So, you know, the MD mentors the VP, who mentors the associate, and there's an easy progression. You know, it's very performance based, right? If you're good at your job, you advance, and it's a meritocracy. And, you know, it attracts very intelligent people.
Yeah.
So it's a very stimulating, intellectually very stimulating place to work.
Kind of problem solution and everything. Yeah. So it's very.
Right. And that's quite good to a certain extent. Then, you know, then it's very project based. So you start, you stop, you start, you stop. If you're somebody who's thinking long term, or who likes the problem, but then actually also likes implementing the solution, then that cycle is too short for you.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
And that's what happened in my case. And some of my friends who started together, we started together, they're still there and they are been very successful. And other people like myself realized that was a great place to start and then launch from.
And I guess it's got to be extremely interesting to really get kind of a helicopter perspective of how business is made. What kind of makes up the economic system that we live in? Yeah. It's got to be very interesting to have a...
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Overlook the flows and everything.
A few years later, when I was actually going to business school, I asked my old boss in investment banking to write me a recommendation. And his question was like, why do you want to do business school? Why do you want to go to business school? I said, well, I realized that I have no idea about business, so I want to learn. And his response was, if you want to learn business, you have to do business.
Yeah.
you can just, and I think that's true. It's applying a lot of these things, whether you've learned concepts about finance or about strategy or about, you actually have to apply them. And when you come into at that stage, I think it's really valuable. Yeah.
But was it here in Spain that you, and like you said, when you project led the solar park, was that when you started connecting like what you want to work with a sense of responsibility? Like, I want to do good things, not only do things, but I want to do good things.
Actually, I think it was I think that came one step later. I think at this point, I was very clear that I wanted to do something different, that I wanted to do something by myself, right? That I was...
Like build something.
Yeah, exactly. It was, now we're calling it entrepreneurial. It wasn't called that before. It was kamikaze, I think was the word for it. But it was very much about, I think it was sort of the breaking point where, you know, I don't want to build a CV. I want to do things that are interesting and think more lateral and jump around. And solar power was something I had no idea about, felt appropriate and felt like something that will have a positive effect. But at the same time, I was very interested in music, and music was something that, I was always been very passionate about. So I was trying to figure out ways in which to go to make that my job.
Consuming music or also making music?
Consuming and thinking about the business model part of music. And so I started getting involved in a few projects with a few friends. We were trying to create merchandise stores for bands on Facebook. We ended up, after business school, but we ended up launching a company out in Asia. And so I went to business school in a place called INSEAD, which has one campus in Fontainebleau in France and one campus in Singapore. And at the end of the program, I stayed in Asia and partnered up with two guys to launch a media and entertainment company between Japan and China. And the idea was, there's all this incredible music and music rights that's in Europe and in the US. how do we get those localized and in, you know, more and more so into Japan and China beyond the, you know, the standard way of the record labels or the film studios, right? How do you do things more exciting? And that was really, that was actually quite a lot of fun. It was, the most intense job I've ever had in my life. The industry is very intense, but also, you know, working life in, you know, in Japan and China is very, very intense.
Mm.
And I think that was, you know, 4 years of that. We were, you know, three partners. As I said, I was a junior partner. My other two, Rick and John, were very much, you know, had much more experience than I had, much more senior.
So you were always trying to catch up.
I was the operations. Yeah. I was hands on behind the curtain. you know, and that meant Monday to Sunday, you know, lunches and dinners and mornings and all the time. I think that 4 years of that, you know, we took a, you know, business that we started with 300 to 350 people. That was what at the end of it was the catalyst. It's like, okay.
Enough of this.
Yeah, this cannot go. This cannot be the way.
Did you know that I used to live in Shanghai?
No, I didn't know that.
It was a long time ago, though. I studied there for 1 year, like early 2000s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Early 2000s. Oh, wow.
So a long time ago, like almost 20 years ago.
Were you in Jiaotong? Or?
No, Huashida.
Ah, yeah, okay. I did a summer in Jiaotong.
Okay, okay, okay. Yeah. We had a place at Zhongshan Park.
Okay.
Zhongshan Gongyan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was in the 2000s, that seemed to be the Laowai
area, right? Yeah, a lot of expats and a lot of exchange students kept coming, and it was still... I mean, I've returned. I've been traveling quite a lot in China, but... like the years after that. And I don't think I would recognize, well, of course, I would recognize like French concessions and the Bund. But apart from that, I don't think I would recognize Shanghai. But it's a happening place for good or worse. And I do not regret my time there.
Yeah.
But I don't feel the urge to go back at all.
I think like you, actually Sarah, who's our production manager at Clutch Mist, and she was also living in Shanghai for a period. We just overlapped when I don't think we would have met, but, and we talk about this together a lot because it's a bittersweet feeling.
Yeah.
Super happening place, super exciting. You know, at the same time, so close. You know, even if you spend time there, if you sort of, you know, speak the language, get to know people, you're very much, you know, it's very clear you're not from there. So it's never welcoming, but it's so happening that you can get caught in that energy and feel very electric about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And all the restaurants and cafes and street foods and everything, it's full of life for sure.
Yeah.
But then again, the traffic and the combustion, like congestion, what do you call it? The traffic.
Yeah.
Traffic congestion.
Yeah, congestion and the pollution.
Yeah.
And no, it was, you know, talking about wearing masks now. You know, that was the first time I was buying masks. And the first thing you did when I left was 2014. And every morning, as you were making breakfast at home, you're checking the pollution app to see if you're going to be able to bike or you're just going to try and take a taxi. In that sense, and the water you can't drink, and you know, that quality of life is, you know, not something you miss.
No. But did that, because you ended up leaving, of course, after those 4 years.
So exactly.
But was that kind of the pendulum kind of just struck the, like, the opposite way? Like, okay, so now I need to, you know.
Yes, that's exactly what happened.
The transition from downtown Shanghai to downtown Duvid.
Yeah, when you say it that way, it basically what happened was, you know, we had the opportunity to sell part of the company, and I didn't want to leave, but my wife, now girlfriend at the time, said, you know, you should look at yourself in the mirror and figure out who you want to be. And so it was fortuitous. I think it was not by me instigating it, but you know, it was well timed because I definitely needed it. So we left Shanghai together on a one-way ticket out, and we spent a year without a phone, without a computer, traveling. And that was my outdoor year. That's when I tried to catch up with normal Swedes in terms of nature and outdoor experiences.
But how were you able to travel without Instagram?
Yeah, where did you stay? How did you find... Yeah, do you remember?
And how did you tell everyone? Where did you post all your selfies?
Exactly. It was so much fun. I mean, now that, you know, that's a few years later, but you know, now I have a kid, you know, and it just seems so inconceivable to travel so free.
Hmm.
And of course, I, you know, at the end of it, I was itching to get to work or to do something, you know, you're like, but it was an amazing year.
But how did you, I'm sorry, when I was traveling within China, I've been as far west as you can go, like in south outside of Tibet, but Tibetan areas. And did you go like the land way, or did you like fly into like Nepal and stuff, or did you go like Central Asia at all? Or
we were for 2 months in Nepal. Mm-hmm. I actually had a good friend from business school, who is from West Kathmandu, and he was getting married, so it coincided with him. But we spent about a month and a half out in the mountains in the Annapurna range. Then we went, you know, I had family in Peru, so I wanted to do that. And then we crossed from Peru to Bolivia, and then from Bolivia to Chile. And we did about 2.5 months down there. We didn't make it down to Patagonia, but we were in, you know, in the desert, in the jungle, in the mountains.
Like backpacking and hiking and...
Yeah. Yeah, we tried to use as much land transportation as possible, try not to fly to too many places. We had also, we had done a project, my girlfriend and I, where I have a nun, an aunt who's a nun in the mountains.
Oh, really?
Over in the mountains of Peru.
Mm-hmm.
She's a missionary nun.
Mm-hmm.
And she had been telling me for a long time how it was very difficult for high school students to go to sort of advance to university in her community. So the idea that we had while we were traveling in Nepal was, is there a way that we can assist, not just financially, but somehow mentor these kids in some way? So we spent some time with my aunt in her region in Cajamarca, in the mountains of Peru, with the community there. And then from there we went, where did we go from... there. Then it was starting to be winter in Europe. So we actually spent about 2.5 months in France, in the Alps. And basically we were trying to power up as much outdoor experiences as possible.
But what did you find? What did you find in the activities? What did you find in the emotions and feelings and being cold and being warm, sweaty, tired? Like, what attracted you to it?
I was surprised by how much gear there was. Right. I mean, now it sounds silly to be saying this as the CEO of an outdoor brand, but I really didn't know what to buy. And whenever, you know, I'm going into a store and we're about to go to Peru and Bolivia, and you go and what are you looking for? Is it waterproof? Is it not? I found that experience very confusing. There's just so much stuff and it's not so clear, and you can't really Google it, and there's reviews. But I found the customer experience very difficult. And then by contrast, I realized, you know, how important it was to have the right stuff. Because when you're there, and, you know, we were in Nepal and you get cold or...
You mean a broken zipper in the wrong place. Yeah. I mean, that can be potentially a problem.
Yeah, exactly. And you always like, it is always contrasted, you know, in Nepal, especially where, you know, you have the Sherpas wearing sandals, you know, and then you're wearing these big things, and then, you know, and then you donate everything at the end of the trip to them. And, but yeah, it is, and it's incredibly important, not just to keep you safe, but also to just make you feel like you're safe, right?
Don't underestimate that.
Yeah, the feeling of, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I, you know, I am looking for adventures, trying to do things. I thought, first of all, I can't be the only person in this world, right? I can't be the one that's just been realizing, that just has realized how important it is to balance stuff, right? Like what I was doing before wasn't sustainable. You have to find the right balance for things. And when you, even if you have some of a balance, looking out for these kind of experiences, you know, it is, you know, more and more people are doing that. So, I thought, you know, there must be a trend here. Must be interesting, right? It must be more people who are trying to do what I've just realized that I should have been doing many years ago. And at the same time, there, you know, the industry itself was a bit of a puzzle, right? I actually did go that year. I went to ISPO as a visitor, and I just remember thinking that, you know, all these brands that are, you know, when you're going into a store in Kathmandu or something, or you see a mountain guide, you immediately put all these brands in such a high pedestal. When you see them side by side in ISPO, you realize that they're all pretty much the same. So it's a bit disenchanting. And I thought, okay, so if we've got a customer journey that I just did as an ignorant customer trying to figure out what to buy, and at the same time, you have an industry that's doing all these things and all these, there's something not working properly, right? I always say that, you know, it's like the industry, you know, every single brand of outdoor, is spending so much time and energy developing products. There's so much R&D. But when it comes to the store as a customer, it's like just another, you know, H&M t-shirt. Every, you know, the next season is another color and then another color. It's like we're making new iPhone versions every, you know, twice a year, but then we are selling them as H&M t-shirts. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was an interesting challenge, an interesting problem to try and figure out.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Had you then decided that I want to work within the outdoor industry somehow?
Yeah. Hmm. I had started thinking about it from, you know, the same drive that took me to work in the music industry, or sort of in the solar industry, right? Mm. Okay, here's an industry, here's things, but I don't have a CV that's going to get me a job. Mm. So let's try and think about a creative way to get into this industry.
Mm. How can I fool the right people?
That- yeah, exactly. How can I fake my way
exactly.
into
classic?
Absolutely. And I admire that even now when we have candidates applying for jobs and things, because it's like, look, I have no idea. I've never been CEO. I've never been CEO of an outdoor company. But here's what I do know. And here's how I think it applies and could be useful. Mm. And don't trust me. Let me prove it. Mm. Right. And I think that attitude is actually quite important.
But what did you think of like Sweden and Scandinavia before Of course, before coming here and before, like, and did connected to that. I mean, Klättermusen. I mean, it's not the obvious big Scandinavian brand, I think.
No.
I mean, how did you go about, like, finding Klättermusen?
I mean, I can tell you what I thought about Sweden before. Actually, I had a Swedish friend in high school. There was a family of Swedes living in Buenos Aires. And he was usually drunk. he was sort of like the one in our group of friends who drank the most. So I had a little bit of a vision of Swedes just being complete party animals, which is not right. But in the case of the outdoor industry, it was very, you know, what I did was something I, you know, I had done when I met my two partners in Asia. I basically started calling brands. And, you know, and so I had met some in ISPO, I had seen some in ISPO, and then I just started, I picked up the phone and called. And one of the calls was to Klättermusen. My idea, and now when I look back at sort of the plans that I had made for myself 6 years ago, was to find a small enough brand that can be molded, right? That isn't quite stuck in the same business model, but a strong enough brand that can support it. And I think, you know, of all the brands and all the owners and CEOs that I spoke to, in my cold calls, I think Klättermusen stood out by far.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fortuitous.
But did you see it as kind of an uncut gem, sort of?
It's, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a 45-year-old brand, you know, with a heritage, on product development and product making and sustainable thinking on the fabrics. And such a quirkiness, such a, you know, it sort of represented for me as a foreigner coming to Sweden. It represented everything that Sweden was, right? I mean, it's non-commercial. It's performance, you know, no compromises. It's stubbornness. It sort of stands for, you know, it's something that you can rely on. It lasts a long time. And no one has heard of it, and that's okay.
It's the Anders Tegnell of outdoor brands.
Yeah, exactly. It's the it's quintessentially Swedish. Yeah.
But is it, because you can also, I can also, if I were to explain Klättermusen, it's also a brand that's very. But now I'm talking about the appearance, for instance. Yeah. It's very it's got a very peculiar style.
Yeah,
you can. It's, I would say it's the brand that you can. Of course, I'm a nerd, so but you can often, like, from a distance, you can see. Okay, so that's a Klättermusen bag, for instance.
Yeah,
and you have a special aesthetic and a kind of a special technique, kind of a special platform for everything. So yes, I understand what you mean. Like it's typical Swedish, but then again, it's kind of because it's not linear.
Yep.
If you understand what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it takes, it took me longer than I expected to understand that.
Yeah.
Actually, if I have to be honest. What I saw in Klättermusen before is product development 150%, right? And that's, you know, our design production team. I mean, it's really a product development machine that starts with the fabric, you know, that then says, okay, if we want to make something with this fabric, what can we make? Right. And so, and then, you know, how can we make sure that that fabric is bringing something new, innovative from a sustainability, from a durability, from a function? Then from the product, okay, how can the product then provide something also new, whether it's the construction or the function or the usage? And then putting that, those are very strong pillars, right? So in order to have those two pillars supported, you need a third strong pillar, and that is the Klättermusen aesthetic, right? That's what sort of makes the whole package come together, because you can have something that's very sustainable, Or you can have something that's very functional. But in order to have both of those, then you need to give that something that really stands out. This maximum safety for you, minimum impact on nature. So I like the fact that our aesthetic is something that blends those two things together in a very distinct way. And we have a philosophy that, you know, that in, as a matter of fact, you need to hide, if you hide the logo, it should still look like a Clutter Museum.
Yeah.
Right?
And it does. Yeah. 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 And it just the name, I mean, the rumor has it that the founder, Pieter Askulv, he just chose a name that didn't sound cool.
Yeah. And that is the mindset of us. I think every person that is working at Clutter Museum now is a little bit of an underdog, right? It's sort of a bit of a, you know, tongue in cheek. You know, you shouldn't take ourselves too serious. You know, the name doesn't need to sound intense, you know, mountainous or
like North Face.
Yeah.
peak performance.
Yeah. I like the fact, you know, I didn't choose the name. I would never change it because I think it's perfect. But it should be not about the name, but all about the name, you know, if that makes sense. You know, you need, you know, it's not about the product, but it's only about the product. And I think that philosophy for our core customers, they get that immediately. Mm. And for our new customers, when you touch the product, you know, that's when you understand.
But what was your, like, how did you go about, like, what was your initial plan for Klettermusen? And how did you, because you were in contact with them and then you kind of applied for the position, or did you just...
I was in touch with Pieter and I told him, look, I love what the brand, what you're doing. And my pitch was very simple. Hey, you're a great outdoor Swedish guy and you work with the products. I'm not great nor outdoor not Swedish, but I'm I know about business and Asia and I've done that, so perhaps we could find a way. What I really wanted to do, and we're still doing at Klettermusen, is how can we attract a customer that isn't your traditional outdoor customer, not because those customers are not important, but because that customer might not know it's, you know, a customer might not know it's a traditional outdoor customer. And, you know, there's customers that care about the function, and then there's customers that care about looking great. And then there's customers that care about feeling like they look great. Mm-hmm. So, those are different touch points. And I thought, a brand like Klettermusen that was so product specific, so product focused, was missing the bridge. Right. So I said, I could bring that, I think. Or I could try and figure it out at least. And he said, okay, that sounds great. But actually, you know, he was already eyeing retirement. Then that came up at the right time. And we sort of, you know, he's still involved a little bit. Me and the new generation of people at Klettermusen sort of took the reins about 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago. And the vision was very simple. We said we want to do exactly what we're doing, but we want to be able to do it for the next 45 years. Mm. And so it means not doing exactly what we're doing. So, but we've been
trying. There's some buttons to be turned, kind of.
Exactly. Being respectful, being, you know, clear what we are, what we're not, but at the same time, not being afraid of trying new things, you know. We're doing, you know, for this autumn winter 20 season, for the first time, ski wear, like ski mountaineering, which was, even using the word ski for us was very scary. Right?
How come?
Well, we've always seen ourselves as Nordic mountaineers, right? And that was, you know, perhaps you were assisted by skis, but it was very much in a horizontal way. You know, we said the Nordic mountaineer goes to the mountain, around the mountain, and back from the mountain. And then using a ski, you know, was really more the ski collection is really like, okay, can we use these fabrics and this mindset of a Nordic mountaineering where you are basically out for 10 days? But can we use it also to work in an environment where you're going up and you're going down with skis, right? Not just up ice climbing, we had done that, but down with skis. And we had to draw, we had to be very clear where the line was drawn between, okay, this is not for the ski piste. You know, this is not for the ski system. This is for when you're skinning up, going over and over and over again. And that it worked, but it was very, it's intimidating when you haven't done it before.
But this, of course, that is what we're talking about now, like the balance between renewing and managing a legacy, of course. But, what was the, what is the reactions from the true believers, long-time customers? Like, have you scared anyone off? Have you received any angry letters?
No. You want the real answer? I think we have, for sure. Yeah, I mean, we went through a phase where we thought we were shooting straight, but we weren't. And customers felt it. Some customers felt it, I'd say. We felt it ourselves, but we were also not, you know, creating a brand, developing products. It requires as much maturity as it does confidence, right? And if you're, you know, if you don't have those two things, then it shows. It shows in the communication, it shows in the product. And, you know, we are a 45-year-old brand, but we're a 4-year-old company. I mean, we are a startup in many ways, right? So, we thought we were doing something right. We weren't. We fixed it. But in those, you know, in those time, you know, the time gap between that is painful, painful for our customers. And, you know, if it's painful for them, it's triple painful for us to see, right? Mm-hmm. For a brand like us that has such a almost cult following, of people, you never want to disappoint anybody. But also you can't operate starting off by not wanting to piss off people. All right. So yeah, it happened. Sorry, if you're hearing this, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry.
Please come back.
Yeah, please come back. Exactly. But, yeah, but also I'm not, I don't regret it. I think it was important for us as a team, I should say.
And I mean, as with almost everything, I mean, in culture or whatever, I mean, everything is in a constant state of progression.
Yeah.
So deal with it.
Yeah.
Sort of.
I also think that it's, you know, something that we learned more and more, is, you know, how can we be closer to the customer without being too close to the customer?
Right.
And what I mean by that is we are creating equipment to enable people to go out and live their adventures, you know, see through their expeditions or, and so that requires us to know a little bit better than you what you're going to need or what you might need, and so that you're prepared. But at the same time, and it's something that has happened many times, and it certainly has happened at Klettermusen, is we just over-engineer it, you know, and then we're almost like we're sitting a little bit in an ivory tower.
Yeah.
Think like we know best. Mm-hmm. And that's not right. Either.
I mean, I've seen, for instance, like your bigger, like backpacks, like the big ones. And I mean, looking at them and trying them, sometimes it's like, okay, so I'm going to need a manual for this.
Yeah.
You see all these probably very smart solutions and small straps and everything. And it's like, okay. It's not like your traditional Swedish backpack.
No. Yeah. Exactly. And that's exactly the point. Everything that we do might be amazing, but if we haven't been able to explain it to you, then we failed.
Mm.
And that's sort of the biggest things we are working on now. Like, okay, it is about pushing the fabrics into new directions, but it's also about bringing the customer along. Because if we can do great things in the lab, but the customer isn't following it or doesn't understand, or then it doesn't matter. Right. So that's always a bit the two faces of a product development heavy company like Latmus.
And a lot of your products, like for instance the backpack, I mean, you don't buy a new 80 liter backpack every year. I mean, you buy time and then you keep it for at least 10 years or something.
Yeah.
So you have to really convince that potential customer that this is the one you want.
Exactly. With the collection we have today, like for autumn, winter 20, the collection that's in the shops, we won 4 ISPO Gold Awards. So we more awards by industry, by a panel of industry judges than any other brand, which is a huge achievement. So we were very happy about it. But that is only part of the equation. Now we need to, you know, it's great that our peers think that this is great products. Can we make sure that it fits the customer needs today? Or if it doesn't, can we make sure that we start to educate them on that journey? And that's a challenge and we're working on it. I think all the brands are working on it, but it's, especially difficult in the hardware, you know, when you're talking about backpacks.
Yeah.
Cause there's a lot of room for innovation, but you can innovate yourself silly.
Exactly. I mean, that's actually one of my questions. Like how, you know, to some extent, you know, after a while, it seems almost silly. Like all the brands are trying to show off, like honestly, like how many times can you reinvent the jacket, the shell jacket, the material, the backpack? Whatever. I mean,
yeah, I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree.
Of course, you can make it lighter. That technology allows you to create thinner fabric with more durability. Of course, I understand that. But then again, it's not rocket science. I mean, it's not.
It's very easy, you know, it's much easier, let's say, I found in the last few years that it's much easier to say, oh, you know, we need this in another color, we need this with a hood, we need this without a hood, we need this in a vest. You know, that's relatively easy. What's very difficult is to say, okay, we need to educate this, it's going to take time. You know, until we have created the demand, then there's no point pushing out products or creating variants of the products. And it's a difficult thing to do because we're, you know, the whole industry somehow accidentally or over time been stuck in a bit of a fast moving consumer goods model. So it just feels like you have to keep feeding and keep feeding and keep feeding. And no one's going to be the first one to step out because that, you know, but I actually think going back to COVID and the impact of it, I think this has been positive. I think we're going to see more carryovers. We're going to see more colors that aren't seasonal. And that's going to make everyone's life a little bit easier.
We've been talking about your customer or your customers. Describe a typical Klettermessen customer.
Good question. I think I would like to think that both you and I are typical customers. The customer we have today,
super extreme, very successful,
great looking, funny,
insanely rich,
insanely everything above. I think if you asked Ida, our marketing manager, she would give you a very clear one page profile of who that customer is. But it is a moving target. I think there's the customers that have known Klettermessen much longer than me that would know products that, you know, better than me. And they are there for sure. And then there's customers like, you know, yourself or I, you know, who are not living necessarily in nature all the time, but it's an aspirational customer. It's also an inspirational customer and it's a functional customer. And if you put those three things together in a person, they're very much a Klettermessen customer.
And then again, it's interesting with a brand such as Klettermessen because you don't always get to choose your customer. Do you? I mean, because you make stuff for people that aspire to do great things within nature, like expeditions and whatnot. But you can also go down to Nitty Gritty on Södermalm, which is a very, very streetwise, like fashionable boutique. Yeah. And you can buy klättermus. And you see like hipster kids, I guess, probably in Tokyo and London wearing klättermus. So how did that go about?
I think, yeah.
Is that always a good thing? I mean, could it be a bit problematic to have to cater for two, in many ways, very different types of people?
My opinion, my personal view on this is that if you are not changing how you think about the product, right? So if the product development, ethos, philosophy, methodology is consistent, whoever is buying the product, whoever you are targeting to, you know, you can, you know, is a customer, right? Let's start with that. Then, you know, the question is, why are they buying the product? You know, are they buying it because they really want to be warm when it's minus 30 degrees? Or are they buying it because they like the color? Or are they buying it because it was, you know, in the Nitty Gritty store next to Comme des Garçons? That's really a different question. But fundamentally, like, you know, we don't have a problem with seeing, I don't have a problem with seeing one of our athlete jackets, with someone wearing the dog, taking the dog out for a walk, or seeing it hanging in a, you know, in Svalbard. So it doesn't, it's not a problem at all. If you start talking about, oh, what do you do? Shoots or campaigns, or I think we always want to make sure that we're inspiring the core customer who's going to use it when they go out in the expeditions. But it also, you know, the reality is that not everyone has that life, right? So you cannot just make it intimidating for everyone else. You have to make it inspirational so that you can get people out there and really take the product out. So we try to strike balances. And today, you know, people are, you know, some people are called hipsters, some people are, you know, but in reality, you know, if you're going into Nitty Gritty store, what I think that customer is looking for is A, something that looks different, something that feels different, and something that is really authentic. And I think that those are very much the same things that our core customer looks for.
So the design team in Åre, they mainly look out the window at the mountain when they design a new product. They don't look at what the fashion bloggers in LA or Tokyo are.
No, yeah, absolutely. No, we don't. That's not who we design for. You know, that's not who we develop for. Absolutely not. It wouldn't be a klättermus product if it was, you know, to be used in downtown anywhere, even in downtown Åre. The product development team, the designers, the production, and certainly our testers, you know, they are the ones that are in charge of making the product.
You're like, I don't know if this comparison will fly at all, but you're like, I don't know any names of them, but you're like a shoemaker in some fancy street in London that makes the same type of leather shoe, like from generation to generation. But all of a sudden, rich hipster kids decides that, okay, so this is cool now. Yeah. But they didn't make them for them. They made them for like old men to wear with suits. But all of a sudden, that's in fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think what then, you know, what Nitty Gritty and that kind of customer likes is that we aren't cool. We are not a cool brand. But you know, when you look at the outdoor brands, we are also, you know, we're like the brand that isn't a brand, right? So it sort of feels a little bit as it has always been intended. I think it feels authentically different.
It's kind of adds to the mystique. It kind of eludes you.
Yeah.
Like it's a bit more difficult to kind of frame in.
We say that you should find clethamusin, you shouldn't find clethamusin everywhere. You should find clethamusin in the right place. Right, so you're in the right place if it's there. And our customer is also, not everyone is our target customer. We're looking for, I remember in the old days when you had a Mini Cooper, if you had a Mini Cooper and you saw another one, you hung. And that's a little bit like that. Whenever I bump into someone wearing clethamusin, it's, you kind of wink.
You do the secret signal.
Yeah, exactly. It's a secret handshake.
Why do you think, even before Corona, the outdoor, at least from a Swedish perspective, like outdoor activities, hiking and heading to the mountains, it was already a thing. And it's kind of exponentially gains momentum.
Yeah.
After Corona, for obvious reasons. But the fashion industry, like high fashion, has been for the last 5 years or something, more and more gravitating to the outdoor scene, like French, like high fashion brands making kind of hiking outerwear shoes and outerwear and so on. Why do you think that is?
My opinion is that the fashion brands, as you said, the luxury brands, are very good at listening to customers. We call it trend seeking or things, but they fundamentally, they have their ear to the ground much more than we do as an outdoor. It's a little bit easier for them. So I'll sort of give ourselves as outdoor brands more credit, but it's easier for them because they don't have to think about function. Right. So it's more of an aesthetics to start with. So then it's like, okay, well, what are people doing? How are they, what are kids doing these days? How are they acting? What are they? And nature has become more and more, and outdoor has become more and more of a trend. And they've been spotting that and trying to cater to it. And then, in the meantime, we have been doing the same thing, consistently doing the same thing from an outdoor brand's perspective. I think that's good from our perspective, that fashion brands are doing it. It's, for example, we have a challenge that is really annoying, that when we're working on a new fabric and we co-developed this bio-based nylon with a fabric supplier in Japan, and we wanted to implement it in all of our down jackets. So we developed it together and said, we can make a nylon. So we can make a synthetic material, bio-based. So we're not talking about recycled fishing nets, etc. This is like, we're going to make synthetic materials with the best functionality, but we're going to make it from bio sources. And we could do it 100% bio-based, but it was incredibly expensive based on our minimums, right? On the quantities we needed. So we said, okay, let's start with 60%. And we thought together with the fabric supplier, if we can launch this into the market together, we can push it to the products and then prove it, then more and more people are going to take on it, right? More brands will use it. But in a way, it was very disappointing to see that the outdoor brands, even the most, recognized as sustainable brands, struggled to do that. And instead, what we've seen recently is that it's this fashion brands. Yeah. That start to put their volumes and their muscle behind and help develop some of these bio-based sources, because it's not just outdoor, it's also sustainability that's taking a whole new energy within the industry, right? And that's encouraging, very much so. Mm. Yeah.
Speaking of sustainability, what does being sustainable mean to clethamusin as a brand? Like from the beginning, from early on to today and into the future.
But I mean, I must say I hate that word because it's so, it's so annoying. It's so frustrating, that word, to me. It's
how come?
Maybe because everybody uses it, I mean, it's like everyone's talking about a movie, then I don't want to watch the movie anymore. We are not sustainable, right? We are not sustainable. We are a brand that's making products, and we're making textiles, and we have backpacks, and we have equipment. We call it equipment. We treat it as products and equipment. We develop it very carefully, but we are having a negative impact on the planet, no matter how hard we try, right? So what we try and do is not to think about sustainability, trying to make things last. You know, we're trying to, every product needs to be thought through as like, okay, can this last, right? And then we hope for the best. And we try to evolve things. So as I said, the bio-based fabric is okay. We still want to have the functionality of a nylon, and if we use the nylon, it's going to last longer. So can we then just make that from a bio-based source instead of, you know, that kind of mentality? So for us, it comes at an initial product development point. Okay. If we're going to go through the whole domino effect, how can we make sure that it doesn't start in, you know, that it starts in the best possible way? And then at the end, how can we make sure it lasts as long as possible? Like, can it be carry over for next seasons? Can we have a good colors and things like that? We do our best, but we are not sustainable, you know, and that's, you know, going back to your question earlier about the customer and the core customer, like you want to be respectful and you want to be sustainable, but you also need to, you know, you need to have room to operate, right? And sometimes when you say like, are you sustainable, or not, it's like, well, I'm not, but I'm in the progress. I'm in the process of being in this area and in this area and in this area. We track those things, you know, from a company perspective. But we are not perfect, and we're not sustainable, and I'm not sustainable myself. I mean, so we have a long way to go. And it's just the reason I hate the word, I think, is because it's not a fair word for people, who are trying to do their best.
You mean it's easy to fool a customer? That's not very.
Yeah. To misguide a customer. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
like greenwash. Yeah. Like you put a fancy tag on the jacket where it says blah, 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 green this and green that. And then it's.
We do every product in our collection is with the same mentality around sustainability, and many other brands do, and many other brands don't. And the ones that don't take the one product or the one capsule collection that is very sustainable and put a lot of PR around it, because the balloon effect of that, the mushroom effect, is that everything else gets a little bit of it. And it's fantastic, because the more, in one way, I admire it, because, you know, the more you do that, the more the consumer will become knowledgeable about it. But on the other hand, it's very different than our approach. So, you know, I think both.
And I guess one problem is that it's no, I mean, honestly, like, any brand can say whatever they want. Like, this is. Mm-hmm. Just make up some numbers and fancy names. But if they are caught with a lie, like if people want to look them up and find out that, wait a minute, this is not, I mean, you're lying. There is no kind of punishment for them. The punishment could be kind of a backlash in social media. And I mean, we all see what's happening with Oatly now these days, for instance, customers losing faith and deciding to go for other brands. But apart from that, it's kind of a low risk to kind of fool customers. Telling everyone that they're sustainable.
Yeah, you know what? Probably one of our biggest struggles, I wouldn't say maybe one of our biggest struggles, but a struggle that we have is that a lot of the organizations that certify things like fabrics, and I mean, a lot of times they themselves are two steps behind.
Yeah.
So, you know, we could say, for example, the whole collection is using GOT certified fabrics. But actually that in itself is not so sustainable from what we could achieve if we don't. So then you kind of, as a brand, you have to make a choice. Are you going to use those third party certifications to make everything easy, you know, or are you going to go your own way and develop something? And then even if it's not GOT certified, yeah. And then you have to choose how much you can push. And, but we're all brands are in different phases of development, let's say, and therefore you can do different things. I think if we were 10 times the size we are now, we might find doing things we're doing now very challenging.
So, I mean, do you want to become 10 times the size? Tough question for you.
Yeah. I think we have a very ambitious plan on where we want to go. And I think the market is there. We are there. You know, our mindset is there. But I don't know if that's 10 times or more or less. But I think if, you know, that question sort of answers itself over time if you just keep doing the right things. Hmm. That's how we see it, I think.
I mean, you've been working with different types of industries, and now you work within the outdoor industry. Like, what's your, how would you describe the outdoor industry as a industry, if you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is it different people that you meet these days compared to the ones you met in the music media industry, compared to the investment banking industry? The mentality, the jargon, the...
I don't know if it's different people. I think we are in the outdoor industry, you have very business-minded people, and then you have very lifestyle-minded people, right? And same thing in the music industry. You have people who, you know, are there for the passion of music, and then there's there who are there because selling more, you know, CDs is better for the business. I think what's interesting in the outdoor business is that it's such a, as you say, it's such a passion, you know, industry that, you know, you have a lot of people who are very dedicated to the missions and really believe in the brands they work for, right? I mean, they become, the brand needs to embody you in an outdoor in order for you to really go for it. I've made a point to always try to bring people into Klatremusen who come from other industries, not from other brands. Not because I don't admire or respect other brands, because I want that sort of exchange of ideas and sort of questioning and sort of trying things. And it's difficult when within the industry, you know. So that maybe that's the right way to think about it, or the way I think about it.
It's mid September as we record this, and it's autumn is in the air literally, and the changing of seasons. What do you think of the changing of seasons in Sweden, and what are you looking forward to at this point? Like, winter is behind the corner.
This is my favorite season in the year, especially in Sweden. In Norway now, it's starting to get yellow leaves, and it's an amazing season, very magical. I'm hoping that we have a good winter, certainly for snow. I think the industry needs it. The summer has been tough. We are not so much of a spring-summer brand, but I know that a lot of our peers have struggled, a lot of our customers have struggled. I'm really hoping that we get the weather shines on us during the winter, and the customer also, I think, needs a good. And me myself, I have to say, I'm dying to go on the snow.
Because you're a split border.
Yeah, that's right. It's a dying breed. It's like being a Jedi, I think.
Yeah. That's good.
These are
I'm
not the
droids.
I'm going
to start using that as well.
Yeah. Are you a split border? Yeah. Okay. These are not the droids.
But it's, I don't know, it's kind of a second coming.
Yeah.
Return of the Skywalker split border. So I think there's some interesting stuff going on.
It's a fantastic, I mean, nothing beats a good powder day on a board. Right.
That's the thing. I mean, I've been, of course, over the years, more and more thinking of like, oh, I really should get back to skis and learn how to ski tour in skis.
Yeah.
But deep down, I know that even though I would take that step, even though I would master skis in some way, I know that that when the day comes that I'm on top of a mountain or something and I'm skiing down, and if it's good, I know what I will think, and I will think, absolutely. I really wish that I would have had my snowboard now, because it's when it's good, it's good.
100%. If you used to go ski touring on the split board, I think you learn to read the mountain so much better.
Yeah.
I mean, the skier can always get out of something, but you gotta read the slopes. You gotta,
yeah.
And that's not to be underestimated.
No.
And it's also, you know, you don't have to transition, you know, so fast all the time.
No.
The split board, just like, you know what? It's more of an enjoyable experience.
Yeah, but that's really a good topic, because it's, for me, for the most times that I've been ski touring, I've been like the one split boarder in a group of very good skiers.
Yeah.
And that's not good for the self-confidence.
No.
But it's I should hang out more with other split boarders, because we share the same problems and strength.
Yeah.
And another thing, two winters ago, I started using my ski poles a bit more, like actually having them in my hands on some of the slopes. It's sometimes it's helpful.
It helps. To your point of like not being the only split boarder, I think there must be a break point quote out there. Like, I don't think you can have too many split boards either in the same group.
No.
Sort of start canceling out each other. You kind of need to feel special. So maybe
two you're right.
or
yeah.
three max. Yeah.
But it's like, it's so annoying every time, like, if the guide is a skier, like 99 times out of 100, and they stop the group and like, okay, so where are we going next? And okay, so, but if you would have stopped like 50 meters in that direction instead, it would have made my day a lot better, because I could just, now I need you. Yeah. You know,
what they're working on, I know, or I've heard, is hard boots.
And that for
a snowboard, or at least hard tips. And that would make the mountaineering part, you know, putting on crampons and getting a little bit more up there, that would make it more enjoyable. Because that's the one thing I feel, you know, on the snowboard boots, when you're going for a little bit of the tougher, you know, climbs at the summits, and you don't have quite the same grip, the same safety.
Mm-hmm. But it's like we said, when it's good, it's good.
And I mean, and I must say, like in Scandinavia, you don't have to go into the Alps. Like you go to Ålesund, and you go to the Sunnmøre Alps, or you go, and in Sweden too, you have fantastic days, 1,000 meters up, and 1,000 meters down, and that's a great day, great day. You don't have, it's just, and with good, you know, you can, with good snow conditions, you jump on the train, you're there, you're back.
Mm. Let's hope for many days like that this winter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for taking your time. And is there anything you would like to add?
Gosh. Do you have any Klatremusen, maybe?
No. I used to have a jacket. I bought it like on a sale, like many years ago, like 10 years ago, something.
Do you remember the name? Or was it down jacket?
No. It was a shell jacket. A very simple, like very classic Klatremusen one. And I had it, and I used it quite a lot for like 3 years.
Hard shell,
yeah. And it felt like bulletproof.
Yeah.
And I sold it secondhand, and I think I got what I paid for it, honestly.
That makes me happy to hear.
Yeah.
It's probably the Brede or something like that.
Yeah, one of those. Because I'm not only saying this, but the material, it was very tear resistant. I had to change a zipper. Not the metal parts, but the zipper
puller.
Yeah, the puller, exactly. I had to change one of those. But apart from that, I mean, the material, it didn't get a mark. It was very durable. Very durable.
Yeah, that's great. Mm. That's great to hear. I will I don't have any. That's a fantastic way to finish. I'm going to drop the mic. See you later.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Husky is produced in cooperation with Naturkompaniet. The music is made by Joel Mull.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.